This is the Volleyball Coaching Wizards podcast, covering everything coaching, motivated and inspired by interviews and conversations with some of the world's great volleyball coaches. To learn more about the project, visit volleyballcoachingwizards.com. Now here are your hosts, John Foreman and Mark Levigieu.
Hey, in this episode, Mark and I get talking about the idea of keeping things simple and avoiding the urge to add complexity the way we coach our players, especially on the technical side of things. Anders Christensen offers some thoughts of his, which are the starting point here. Unfortunately, I goofed the first time we recorded this, and, well, I should say I didn't record it, so that was the problem. So this was the second go-round. Hopefully it turned out at least as good as the first one, maybe a little bit better because I think my voice is better for it. All right, enjoy.
My first principle is has to be easy, has to be simple, and has to be, second, comfortable. And like this, I have like 5, 6, 7 points.
Yeah.
But if you make difficult and hard to do, not comfortable, it will be very difficult to execute, I think.
With comfortable, the first picture that comes into my head is as you mentioned, maybe the having the really low position in defense that's difficult to maintain, and having the hands out at a in front of the body at a specific angle, that's a really uncomfortable position. And I can remember, maybe it's only 3 or 4 years ago now, that it occurred to me one day how uncomfortable that is and how unnatural it is for somebody to hold that position. Why would you ever ask somebody to try and move or think or from that position?
No, but I mean, if you try to force people to take different stance of the body, and they like you say, it's difficult to hold, and it's even difficult to think about this all the time. You have to think about the ball and to be in a position that you are relaxed and that you can easily move from that position. I think it's so, for me, it's so basic that why should I have a position that is more difficult to move from? I must have a position that is easy to move from.
Yeah.
And in blocks, it was once in the trend that everybody should stay on almost on their toes and with their with their hands as high as possible.
Yeah.
And what happens when you have to move outside, or even block the first tempo? The first thing people will do is put their hands down, the arms down, and then up again. And to move sideways, you have to get your center of gravity lower, and you have to take your hands down and you start to move. So it's a totally counterproductive posture to have, for example. And many of these you find. Why you do this? And but somebody told me I should stay here if they play first tempo. And what do you do then? Yeah, then I crunch and then I jump. It's if you just think about it, the solutions are mostly simple.
The example that Anders gives, or that you guys talk about anyway, that comes up most frequently when we talk about body position and being able to move and have to change position to move, always seems to be blocking. And I can remember coaches once upon a time, I can't remember when this started or when it might have finished in certain places, but teaching what they call, you know, the tippy-toe blocking technique for middles, where they had their hands up fully extended and they were basically on their toes in order to try to defend against the quick attack, while at the same time, theoretically, still being able to transition to block outside should that quick attack not come. It seems to me like we've largely gotten away from that. There may still be pockets of people who are doing it, but it looks like people have at least given up on that. But there is still, and you can still see this in blocker starting positions at all levels, where they start with their hands way up high, and as you guys talk about, inevitably have to pull their arms down before they move or jump.
Yeah, on that particular note about the hand positions, I remember the first time I heard the contrary opinion, when somebody had done a video analysis of the best players in the world and discovered that every single one of them on every single instance brought their hands down before they put them up again. So it turns out to be actually impossible to press from that position with your hands above your head. So the next logical step is to bring hands to a lower position, that you just make one movement from low to high. And that's what we see a lot more now at the higher level. But as you say, at other levels, you can still see the holding the hands high version.
Well, even blockers, when they kind of set their initial position, especially when they're in service, you see them all, you know. And I know some of it is, we won't call it screening because screening is illegal, but
it's actually not.
Well,
it is screening, but under a very, very peculiar set of circumstances.
Right, right. The act of actually screening by the rules is illegal, so they're not screening. They're just putting their hands up. But then again, they take them down as soon as anything starts to happen. So, you know, it's kind of a, what's the point? What are you doing? And, you know, and never mind what happens when they actually, you know, turn to go outside. The hands automatically come down as soon as they make the turn.
To make a cross step, the hands have to go down. Otherwise, you end up with some kind of, Irish dancing
move. Yeah, I'd like to see somebody actually try it and see what it looks like.
I'm sure I've seen it.
The other area for me, and you guys talked about this a little bit, is in defense, where people just get or can get very, very low. And I've seen even libros in the men's game whose starting position, just when they're in base, is ridiculously low. And I'm just looking at them going, how in the world do you think you can move from that position?
I completely agree, and the position that people get into is in defense in lots of cases, I think is ludicrous is a word that springs to mind. And as you mentioned with blocking, to have the feet on the toes, or to have a weight on the toes in blocking, seems pretty dumb, but in defense, what you often see is weight forward is interpreted as heels off the ground, which, a ballet dancer can move from that position, but only after 15 years of practice. And for a volleyballer, from there, you're in no position to move at all.
Right, right. And, of course, there's the balancing line that a lot of us coaches deal with between getting players to actually bend their knees on defense versus just, you know, bending at the waist. The lazy version of defense, especially for tall players.
And the other one is the hand position even. And you see this, and there's, I'm sure, although I haven't counted them, but I'm sure there are dozens of videos on the internet of coaches teaching their players to be in defense with their hands held high and their palms up and all sorts of weird, uncomfortable positions. And we're talking about simple and comfortable, and I'm convinced that the easiest position from which to do anything is a comfortable position.
Right. Right, yeah, and I think we as humans, and not just coaches, but just generally as a species, seem to like to build complexity into everything that we do. There's this overwhelming need to, in order to improve something, you have to make it more complicated. When in reality, a lot of the times, it's the complication that's making it hard to make anything better. You end up having to strip out all the complication before you can make legitimate changes. And in some cases, start over from scratch.
My brother talks about a clinic that he saw with an Olympic gold medal winning yachting coach, and the yachting coach one of the best in the world, if not the best in the world, talked about a rule of three. And he said that every technique and skill in his sport, and he, I guess, at least strongly implied other sports, can be broken down into three key points. And the quality of the coach was defined by the ability to identify those 3 points and to keep on those, to keep everything related to those points. And I think that's a pretty powerful message.
Yeah. Now you've mentioned, let's say, a forum discussion that you kind of sort of got into, but then quickly delved out of. That's something to do with cupped hands blocking.
Oh, well, you made the point of needless complexity, or complexity for the sake of being complex, and I can't remember exactly what the forum topic was. Maybe about blocking, or it was about blocking in some context, and some coach from somewhere was absolutely adamant that the best coaches, the best blockers in the world, cupped their hands at the full extension of their block, so that the hand was in the shape of a ball, so they were able to control the ball on contact. And I pointed out to him that, well, I didn't point out, I made the suggestion that that wasn't actually the case, that's the last thing that players were able to, and B, actually in practice did, and he couldn't be persuaded. In fact, he got a little bit angry at the idea that players didn't cup their hands at block.
Anger on the internet? You must be joking. But it does bring up.
Did you notice my deep breath then as I? As I composed myself.
Yeah, but these examples that come up when people are coaching things, or in seminars when they're showing why they coach certain things or think they should be coaching certain things, brings up just, it's something that I've heard of in another context from the perspective of the well-chosen example, where you naturally pick things that tend to confirm what your hypothesis is. But at the same time, there's another element to it, in that just because we see the top players doing things a certain way doesn't mean that's necessarily the best way to do it. It may be the best way to do it for them. It may not be the best way to do it for every player. Because there may be dozens, thousands, hundreds of thousands of other players doing it the same way who aren't nearly as good. You know, we have to factor in the fact that if you're looking at guys at the top level of the game playing for the national team or playing for the elite clubs, there are other elements at work. It's not just about how they mechanically execute that given skill.
No, but what you more often see on the aforementioned blogs, etc., is the ignoring of what the best performers do on the basis of, well, they're the best performers, they can get away with doing it some different way. And that I find to be about the most illogical argument I can think of. So you can't watch good players doing something because they just do it wrong. They're just good players because they're good players.
Sure, and that's the other end of the argument.
The good players are good players because for mental reasons, for physical reasons, but also for mechanical reasons. And if they do something a certain way, it's because they have an innate, or they not an innate, they have an advantage from doing it that way. And coaches who ignore that for whatever reason, I think at the very least, cutting off their nose to spite their faces.
Right. Well, now, to that end, we bring up a certain Ingepath who defies logic, shall we say, in certain things that he does. And you've even kind of jokingly said you almost one day let your players practice doing one of the things that he did in a match.
There was a famous match point of the European Championships where he hit a shot from behind his head that went off the block and out. And I, of course, that was sort of posted around the internet 500 times of an example of his genius and why he's unique and all those kinds of things. And they overlook in that moment a couple of things. And the first one being that that's not what he meant to do. That wasn't his plan to show everybody up and make a name for himself. What happened in the play is that the timing between him and the setter was off. He was a little bit early. The ball was a little bit behind his head. And he had a solution for that situation.
Exactly.
And it was an emergency solution. And his creativity perhaps was that he was able to use that in that given moment. But it's that was all it is. And the point I made, or the idea I had of getting my guys to practice it, was that it has done the rounds of the internet, for one thing. So if I was coaching juniors in particular, that's for sure that's going to be the thing that everybody wants to do. And so instead of having them thinking about it and talking about it and whatever, I proposed to actually set aside 10 minutes of training time for them to practice. And it's the thing that there's a couple of reasons being, one is that there is something to it. It's creating an advantage from a negative situation. So those are the things that push the game forward, the exploration at the edges of what's currently possible. And the second one is that those are the things that inspire young people to play when they see those videos, when they see those things that they want to go out and try themselves. And coaches want to be controlling all the situations that happen in their gym and making sure the players only do things the right way and so on and so forth. But that's only part of their role.
Right. All right. Well, let's go back to the simple thing, the simple and easy.
Your pet never does anything that's simple and easy.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm sure even his coaches, who are used to seeing what he does, every once in a while go, what was that? But anyway, to the point that you were making earlier about the yachting coach.
Yes.
Three points, three key concepts for any particular skill. Mm-hmm. I think Tom Tate made a similar sort of observation in his interview, certainly with respect to hitting, where he said, you can break hitting down to basically run, jump, and in his mind, from a kinesiology sort of perspective, throw, because the arm swing in volleyball is very similar to the throw in, another sport, like baseball or football or something like that. So it's run, jump, throw. Going a step further, one of the things that he really railed against in his interview was the idea of the quote-unquote gurus out there spouting off whatever philosophy they've got in terms of teaching techniques, and the vast majority of them doing things that have no basis in, the physiology of the athletes.
Mm-hmm.
So there's two parts of it. There is, you don't know what you're talking about, coach, and we're making things too complicated. So, it all kind of starts boiling down to, being really good at communicating coaching cues and limiting the number of cues that you use.
Yeah, I completely agree with that, and there are in volleyball a few of the skills that you actually can't measure. You can't prove one way or another what a better technique is than another, because it's based around a whole series of assumptions. And spiking is obviously one that's an exception, because that's about creating power, etc. But the finger pass, the underarm pass, there, you can't ever prove one thing is better than another. You just don't have the scientific possibilities to do that.
Right. Yeah. And there was that whole debate that got stimulated at the U.S. High Performance Clinic, Coaches Clinic last year, when T. Lee was in and he was describing his bent arm reception technique and talking about allowing for a crossover step for a ball that was outside the body line that mm-hmm. had a lot of people, shall we say, up in arms.
Yeah.
Not to pun too much, I hope. Just, you know, in horror, the idea, how can you do service eve without straight arms and locked elbows? And how can you possibly use a crossover step, to pass a ball? It's just, that doesn't work. And you and I kind of talked about the idea of a lot of this stuff being, a lot of service eve being developed at a time when serves were not nearly as powerful as they are today, even at lower levels. If you're coaching 12 and unders or 14 and unders, then the kids have more time to do stuff. But at the same time, they're younger and they don't move as quickly. At the upper levels of the game, both men and women, the time from serve contact to passer contact doesn't allow for a lot of the really nice, clean mechanics that a lot of coaches seem to want to teach.
Yeah, you hear, or I hear often, that the technical level of players is much lower than it used to be, and that the players in the 80s and 90s had a much higher, a much better technical level, to which I find a completely ridiculous idea, because the game is the game, and the game is much faster and more dynamic and so on, and the technical level must by definition be at an extremely high level to cope with the demands of the game. And I think often I've written about this, talked about this a lot, is that people confuse the aesthetics of a movement, how what it looks like, with its effectivity, with its effectiveness, and the two things are not the same.
Right. And bringing Tom Tate back in, one of the points that he made in his conversation was, when it comes to service eve, or defense for that matter, it's platform angle. That's at the end of the execution, that's what matters, because that's going to determine where the ball goes after it makes contact with you. Everything else is just preparation.
Exactly. The only thing that counts in the end is the angle of the part of the arm that contacts the ball to the target, and the target is the angle between those three objects. That's the only thing that counts. Everything else is just aesthetics and an argument over which is the best way to get to that contact position.
Right. Just out of curiosity, when was the last time you saw a true two-person serve receive executed?
I don't think that such a thing exists at this point in history.
Oh no, I can't even imagine it these days. I got away with using it in, I think it was 98, with a boys' high school age group team, because I had two really good passers and everybody else was quite mediocre at best. But we weren't facing jump serves. Everything we were facing was relatively easy float serves. And we got away with it and we won our tournament. But these days I can't even imagine going with a straight two. You can have two who take up a large portion of the court and others who have other responsibilities, but not just a straight two.
Yes. Yes, you'll see often two primary receivers. So you'll see of the three receivers, only two of them being involved with the play. But If you actually look carefully, there's always more people involved with the reception. So part of the court, the middle blocker will be taking part of the court for the short serve, so that the players can move around and cover the area differently. The third receiver seems to be out of the play, but isn't really, and so very, very rarely you might see a real two receiver lineup.
Right. All right. We kind of wandered around quite a bit. Anything else that you could think of, just in terms of the simple, non-complex side of things?
I think Einstein has a great quote that I should have had prepared for this about simplicity being the object of everything, and I think the rule of three is really something valuable there. I think just the idea of a player in every moment being relatively comfortable with his or her situation, his position on the court, his ability to move, and a relaxed position is a much better one to move from. So I think what Anders said as a pretty simple, almost throwaway comment, I think is or should be the basis of all our technical work.
Right. So as coaches, we should be thinking about making things simpler for our players, not more complicated.
We should always be trying to make things as simple as possible. Volleyball is a simple game. It's only coaches who make it complicated.
Thanks for listening. We hope you enjoyed this episode. For show notes and more, visit volleyballcoachingwizards.com/podcast. Got an idea for a future episode or want to ask a question? Send an email to podcast@volleyballcoachingwizards.com.